And we can get started on our next exciting installment of How Buddhism Helps. So it's a short course, just 3 weeks. We've had our first week, which was the dive in the deep end. And so I might just do a little recap about that. The course, How Buddhism Helps, is for whether you're a Buddhist or not. It's just to kind of take the most salient aspects of the path from here to enlightenment and see how they're immediately applicable in our life now, so that we get an experience of change in our circumstances, our life, our attitude to things. And then we can also become aware that the long-term benefits are really vast, that the Buddhist approach or the Buddhist view, it's a really big picture. And that's incredibly helpful for us. So we can get the immediate benefit, and we can also rest assured that there is a long-term benefit as well. Doesn't mean you have to become a Buddhist, just means you can use whatever's useful in Buddhism for yourself. So you might have come along with a problem or a question or an issue. I mean, we're not short of any of those. And they're good to keep in mind as a starting point. And then we kind of use them as a springboard to discover truths about ourselves and the world, and to regain that big picture, because most of our problems come because we're so kind of tunnel vision and narrow-minded. We get really caught up into the details and the contents and forget the big picture. So I will just get up the screen share for a moment and we can do our recap. This week is on what's called renunciation, and it's a Buddhist term. I mean, it's universal, but has a particular meaning in Buddhism. And I've got to say, not the meaning that I thought it had, because usually when I hear the word renunciation, I'm like, oh, that doesn't sound very fun, but it's okay. I'll explain. This is, if you've got a phone or something, that you can get the QR code for this book, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism. So it's a very clear and immediate kind of commentary by Lama Yeshe on this three principal aspects of the path, composed by Lama Tsongkhapa. That's a really good starting point for the study of Buddhism, because you get the main aspects in order. So for Buddhists and the non-religious, we've got a meditation today as well to integrate our theory into our experience. And in a moment we can talk about the worksheets as well. What we've covered today, last week, was the first one, which was the principal aspect of wisdom, of understanding reality and how things exist. Nothing less than that. So one way of becoming familiar with how things exist, there were three levels, from the most obvious to the most subtle. So the most obvious, causes and conditions. Then in the middle there, parts, the parts that make up the whole. And then the most subtle, the imputation. So I thought I'd just give you a couple of examples. Causes and conditions. For example, the value of a dollar. So a dollar's not a dollar. A dollar's just an idea, isn't it? And it depends on causes and conditions. It depends what country you're in as to how much your dollar is worth. So our Australian dollar isn't worth nearly as much in America as it is in Australia. If you're American, you come to Australia, you will find yourself rich. It also depends, it has fluctuations, doesn't it, from the stock market. And just recently, I read that some fellow had invested in Bitcoin, and he'd thrown out the device where, back in the day, he kept his Bitcoin information, and nowadays it'd be worth about $600 million. And so he's actually, this guy just last month bought the refuse tip where he thought he's thrown that device out, so that he can search through the tip to retrieve the Bitcoin thing so he can get his $600 million. So you might think you have $600 million, but it's just an idea, because what if you can't get it? So it really depends on the causes and conditions. Then we've got parts, and this one, conventionally, we have the parts of our house, the parts of our body, the parts of our identity, and we have a kind of a generic image about it, our house or our identity, and it's the conventional reality. But when we start going, well, for instance, who am I really? And we start investigating, we can't find who we are, because we find, well, on one hand, for instance, I'm a daughter. But my mother's died, so am I still a daughter? My mother, she was a daughter and a mother. On one hand, you can be a friend to someone, on another hand, you're not such a good friend with somebody. So on one hand, you're a student, another, you're a mentor. And the experience of all of these is really quite different. So when we try and figure out who are we really, that urge to grasp onto the real me, that's the problem. Because there is no real me. It all depends and it changes. And it's by the grasping onto the identity, I'm this, for instance, I'm a French teacher or something, that when you are no longer a French teacher, then you have a crisis. Who am I? I'm nobody. And it's distressing. So the parts, it can be quite confusing, because we think we're there and we are conventionally, but it can't be found ultimately. And we get mixed up about that. So that leads us to the most subtle level of how we exist, which is imputation. And a valid imputation, so an imputation on a valid base by a valid consciousness. So, for example, a diagnosis. We might be undergoing some kind of illness or sickness, and it depends. It's important that we get the correct diagnosis. If we're diagnosed with something and it's actually not true, we'll have all of the treatments and everything, and it's not going to help us. So ultimately, we actually can't even find any sickness or any diagnosis, but on a conventional level, it matters. It matters that we get the right one. So it's not just a willy-nilly. It's not just we can go, well, I choose to have this disease and not that disease. That won't happen either. It won't help either. So the imputation, to understand that on a conventional level, it's important to have the correct one, and to also understand that it's just conventional. And that actually, before we get the diagnosis, even that disease or that diagnosis does not exist until it's given the name. Anyway, so that's rounded in about 5 minutes or less. Then we had some reflection questions for you to do during the week, and a little meditation about from Lama Yeshe about a dependently arising self. And just a way of kind of analyzing, so that we don't get so caught up in the appearances. So I'm going to put you onto gallery view and now see, did anything come up, either with the worksheets, the reflections, with the meditation, or just randomly anything at all during the week? Now is your chance. How have we been going?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really given me the reflection meditation from Lama Yeshe has really given me an insight on how I tend to think about myself, like on a deeper level. And yeah, and it brought up for me, like, most of the time I'm running on, like, I'm not doing enough, I'm not achieving this or that, I'm behind. And it was like, oh, just to check in. And it just gave me that reality of like, wow, that's where my mind is a lot of the time, even though I'm doing things on the surface level. So yeah, getting that deeper insight was helpful for that.
And also there is a thing I've heard about, like a modern thing about there being virtue in busyness. And I
Right.
think that's kind of like a it's kind of a capitalist hangover, really.
Right.
And in a way, I mean, and it's almost a bastardization of trying to make our life meaningful. And so we get quite stressed about it, and so then we just try and be busy, and we think if we're working or we're producing, then we're worth something. If we also get stressed about it, that's an indication that there's something missing, there's something not quite right. Because, our lamas, our teachers, they're very busy too, but we're not stressed. And we'd be really worried if they were stressed, wouldn't we? So there's, and when I think about the work that, say, someone like Geshe Zopa does, or Geshe Sherab, the amount of projects they're involved in, and people that they're helping, and pujas and practices and teachings and study, and who they're looking after and mentoring all these other people, and online teachings, just like, how are they doing it? And yet it's being calm. So again, I think it's a lot to do with the attitude to the work too. So anyway, I'm glad to hear, Tyler, that it had a quite an effect. What else? How have we just been going this week? How's the week been going?
Well,
Linda.
I just wanted to say too, and completely opposite of what Tyler said, I have a concussion that I'm recovering from, so I haven't been able to do anything. And that has been actually more difficult for me than trying to keep busy. So it's been, it's a very strange place to be in when you're always doing something all the time and feeling like you're being productive. And so it's for me, the last few weeks have been a complete opposite of that, because with a concussion, you're not supposed to do anything. So it's been very strange. I very uncomfortable. Let's put it that way. It's been very uncomfortable because I prefer to be busy and doing something and feeling like I'm being productive, or and it may be just a big illusion, but I feel like I'm contributing. I'm just sitting there doing nothing. I feel like I'm completely doing nothing. I'm making no contribution. So
Yeah, that's right. So that's the appearance of doing nothing as meaning nothing. But they're not the same thing, right? So we've got the momentum, of course. A living being, our momentum is to act, to be involved. And so we have a habit and a momentum of that. But then we've externalized it. And so we think that acting or being worthwhile is to do with the external activities.
But I think it also speaks to who am I? If I'm not doing things, what purpose do I
That's
have?
exactly right. Yeah, it's like the bride stripped bare, isn't it? It's like your the whole personality, all the many of the causes and conditions, are changed and stripped away, and that's you're living this meditation, and what is left? Who am I? So all you have to do with that is to sit with the question. That's it. Which is phew, you don't have to do anything else.
Thank goodness.
And in fact, you've got the perfect conditions to do so, because you have to. You can't even feel guilty about not doing anything. So, who else gets a lucky break like that?
Except that there's a part of me that does feel guilty, even though I have a reason, a legitimate reason. I still feel a little bit guilty about that.
Yeah, that's right. And so then you can go, yep, I feel guilty, but it's not necessarily true.
Ah, yeah.
Because there's the two things. So that's okay. Fantastic. Oh, that's really fascinating. I mean, I'm really sorry that you have a concussion. It's also it can become something incredibly useful. I found the real disasters in life. Like years ago, I broke my ankle, and so I was on crutches. And I broke it really badly, and so being on crutches, you lose your independence, and to such a degree that you can't even get yourself a glass of water because you can't carry the water to where you want to sit. And I just found this unbearable to be at the mercy of everybody else and not have my independence. It was deeply shocking. But at the same time, I was living in a share house, and one of the guys that was living in the share house was a thalidomide baby. So he was born with 1.5 legs and really strong arms, 1.5 legs. That's right. So he was. That's and actually he'd joined the circus because he was incredibly strong upper body and could do all of these amazing tricks. Alternative circus. So he was infinitely kind to me. He would make jokes and he'd say, "Hey, let me race you to have a glass of water and carry the whatever," or he'd go, "Here, I'll throw my sticks away and hop, and you go on your sticks, and who's going to win?" These things. Thanks to his kindness, I was able to get through because I was thrown into panic and depression through that experience. But it was deeply humbling. And just to recognize how dependent we are on others all the time without even knowing it. And that whole meditation of the kindness of others that the gurus talk about, which I just never got. Then suddenly I was like, ah. Not, it's not about niceness, it's about the kindness of others. So yeah, it's kind of like these disasters are like a wrathful teaching, a difficult teaching, but you'll be able to get so much out of it. So courage, and thank you so much, Linda. Anybody else? Anyone else have anything to share? How you've been going this week, or with our sense of identity, who we are, appearances? Okay, well, if at any time you've got questions or comments to put in, then please just unmute and I'd love to hear. Okay, well, let's I'll just say a little bit about what we'll do today, and we can set our motivation. So we're going to focus on renunciation, which is about how to not be distracted by the external circumstances and all the catastrophes and things, how to not be distracted from our core values, what really matters to us. How to not be sabotaged by losing our goal or losing touch with our values. A little meditation on letting go of worldly concerns, and at the end, how to keep a level head, including how to identify what is a valid path or a spiritual path that's something that you can rely on. So with that, let's just take a moment to set our motivation, adjusting your posture so that your spine is naturally straight and your posture is relaxed. Take a deep breath, and when you breathe out, let go of all the tension and discomfort, anything held in especially the neck and the shoulders. And think about how just even coming along tonight, you're doing something beneficial for yourself, but also for everybody else, the immediate people that you are in contact with, but also for the long term to create a peaceful and harmonious world. And that just by contemplating these things, and even by being confused about them, we are developing our wisdom. We are dismantling our confusion and ignorance. And in this way, we'll be able to, just by our very presence, contribute to a better world. And in particular, by focusing on these three principal aspects of the path, the wisdom and the renunciation and bodhicitta, we can, if we work on these, it will lead us all the way to nirvana and enlightenment for the benefit of all. So this is the potential that we have. So let's set that as the big picture goal, and then everything else that comes along, all of our immediate issues, benefit for the self and benefit for others. Okay, so with this motivation, let's have a look at renunciation. I have a little slide I'll get up just to introduce us. So, what is renunciation? It's the wish to be free of the cycle of craving and dissatisfaction, sometimes known as the rat race, samsara. So this wish to be free of that cycle go it may go up, but then it goes down again, and it's just exhausting. And the Tibetan term, I don't know Tibetan, but apparently it's got something to do, another way that you can translate it is the determination to emerge, to definitely emerge. So what, emerging from what? From the ocean of samsara, from all of the confusion and the disturbing emotions and the bondage of samsara. And it's actually represented in the eight auspicious symbols. You're the golden fish jumping out of the water. Or here, a goldfish jumping out of the bowl. That's the representation of renunciation, definite emergence. Now, what are we renouncing? First off, when I heard the term renunciation, I just thought, oh, that means I can't do anything fun immediately. And I've always somehow associated with that. Definite emergence has a much nicer ring to it in my mind. But actually, what we're announcing is, it's like, if we get it right, it's like if you find something poisonous on your hand and instead you go, whoa, get it away from me. So that's renouncing a poisonous insect. So when we renounce, we're renouncing several things. And at first, the one that we all do is renounce suffering. And we don't even have to think about that. None of us want suffering. We all recoil from suffering, not just humans, but animals as well. So we all do this. And whenever suffering hits us, it's like, I don't want this. I'm sick of it. And then we start thinking about, well, how did it come about? So, yes, we're renouncing suffering, but we all do this already. It's not enough. It's not enough just to want to get rid of the suffering, is it? We're not renouncing happiness. There's nothing wrong with the good things in life, and there's nothing wrong with feeling good and okay. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy. Again, that's something, it's not an intellectually acquired belief. It's something we instinctually, everything that we do, we're trying to be happy. Even as we're here in class, we'll be adjusting our seat because we're trying to get comfortable. So, whole time we're searching for satisfaction, comfort, happiness. Nothing wrong with that. But also, that's not enough either. Because for one, we don't quite know where the happiness is. We're searching for it out there and all sorts of unstable things, and it just doesn't give us the satisfaction that we're yearning for. So there's something quite unique about Buddhist renunciation. So, yes, we're renouncing suffering, but we all do this already. No, we're not renouncing happiness. Nothing wrong with happiness and enjoying things. But what we're renouncing is the causes of suffering. And this is something that we haven't done before. So what happens generally, because we're ignorant or confused about the nature of reality, about the nature of who we are, how we exist in the world. And because we are so dominated by our senses, we look outside of ourselves for happiness. This just happens. We don't have to concentrate on it. Our attention is just drawn. And because we look outside of ourselves for happiness, and outside of us is, it's very circumstantial, isn't it? It depends. So therefore, we go up and down. We go up and down continuously. So this renouncing the causes of suffering, I'll give you a really great example. Some of our students went off on pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya over January. It was quite hot, apparently. And so one of the ladies, she came back. She's lost all this weight. She looks fantastic. She's tan. She's lost weight. She's really happy from being on the pilgrimage. And so I was saying, you look like 10 years younger and must have been great. She said, yeah, it was great, but it was a little bit difficult because Miffy, Indian food just does not agree with me. And she said, even when they finally went to pizza shop, they put chili in the pizza sauce, and she was like, nothing agreed with her. So there it was, all this Indian food looks delicious, tastes delicious. The result is not what she wanted. So what happened was she learned, oh, I can't have any of that food because disaster. So this is renouncing the causes of suffering. So it doesn't mean that the pizza or the curry doesn't look any good anymore. No, it looks great, but you get the rest of the story. You understand what the result is going to be. And so naturally you go, whoa, I am steering clear. So that's renouncing the causes of suffering. Whereas me, I remember when I was little and I just loved cheese on toast. And my father would take me out, he had visiting rights every fortnight or something. So we'd go out and he'd say, what would you like to eat? And I'd go, oh, cheese on toast. And so then we'd have a picnic, we'd have cheese on toast. And then when he'd drive me home, I'd throw up in the back of the car. What happened? So there you go. I didn't quite put it together. And he couldn't believe it that I couldn't remember what was in the result. But all I was thinking about was how much I love cheese on toast. So it's not a value judgment. It doesn't happen to other people. But whilst we still go after what appears fantastic without understanding its nature or the effect it has on us, we're going to experience the suffering. So identifying the causes of suffering, though, is tricky, and that's what we really talked about mostly last week. This week we're going to be having a look at, well, what happens when we follow those appearances. Questions or comments so far? How are we going? So here's the next one. All the suffering isn't quite the same. So we've got three levels of suffering as well, from the most obvious suffering of pain. Physical pain, discomfort, it really affects us. Mental suffering and turmoil, depression, anxiety, grief, all of these experiences that can really rock our world. So if we have a disability that we're born with, that we can't do anything about. So all of this is kind of counted as the suffering of suffering. It's obvious pain. We can identify it. And generally, if we are experiencing pain but we can't find the name for it, then often say the medical community might gaslight us, might say it's all in your head and whatever. And then years later, they do studies and they discover, oh, fibromyalgia. How about that? It wasn't all in your head. So various things like that, it's the suffering of pain, it's there. And we can identify it, even if the powers that be don't always identify it. But there's a second type of suffering, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls it the suffering that we are seeking. Isn't that amazing? In most of the Buddhist texts, it's called changeable suffering, i.e., happiness, ordinary happiness, the suffering that we are seeking. So it's when we are seeking the ordinary enjoyments, like melted cheese on toast, because we just have, or just, I just had that short-term view. I didn't see the rest of the story. So it's like I'm seeking the suffering. I don't even know it. Put a photo here of picture of pretty much me for 15 years as an alcoholic. Delicious bubbly champagne, but then the result. So the suffering that we're seeking isn't because we're stupid. It's because we are overtaken by the appearances of things, how things first appear, delicious, fantastic, nice. And it's not that those things are inherently wrong or bad, and it's we shouldn't feel guilty about it, nothing like that. It's just that they change into their opposite. So the delicious bubbly champagne and the feeling that comes along with that, after a while, changes into its opposite. Hangover. Because they all of these things are come from circumstances beyond our control, we have no control over them. They change. So, for instance, has anyone here ever had a hangover? Yep. Okay. So a few of you will admit to it. I'm going to admit to it with both hands. Okay. So we have a hangover. We pretty much know why we're hungover because of what we did the night before. Has anyone ever had more than one hangover? Had two hangovers? Aha. So there you go. So that's the suffering we're seeking, because if we had to put it together, right? The fact that we do it again. Poor humans. That's what Robert says. Yes, for us, we try. What is, here we are. We try so hard to be happy, don't we? But we really need to have compassion for ourselves. Yes, that's right. So not telling ourselves off or not saying you're stupid, because this is deeply ingrained at an instinctual level, and we can change our instincts just through awareness, bringing it into consciousness. So my friend on pilgrimage, it took just a few days for her to change her instinctual response for yum curry to no way, baby. I'm gonna have yogurt and rice. So begins with an intellectual understanding, and then we apply it, and then we change our behavior, and we actually can. That one's a little bit more tricky, but again, it's certainly not the most subtle. So the most subtle one is the type of suffering where we are dominated by ignorance. So none of us want problems, but we continually encounter problems. In fact, we continually run towards problems. And generally, why is this? Because we're seeking happiness outside of ourselves. So we want happiness, but we also want to keep the causes of the suffering. So we can't have both, can we? It's not going to work out that way. We want to drink all the champagne, but we don't want the hangover, as if they can be separated. So here, a moth to the flame. I have this story here. I've got a couple of things to read to you about this. So one's from Lama Yeshe in the booklet, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism. This one here. So the word renunciation has different connotations. People get scared that they'll lose their pleasure, but without renunciation, there's no way out. First of all of us consider that we'd like to be free from ego mind and the bondage of samsara. But what binds us to samsara and makes us unhappy is not having renunciation. So, what is renunciation? What makes us renounced? The reason we're unhappy is because we have extreme craving for sense objects, for samsaric objects, and we grasp at them. We are seeking to solve our problems, but we're not seeking in the right place. The right place is looking at our own ego grasping. We have to loosen that tightness, that's all. I want you to understand that renouncing sensory pleasure doesn't mean throwing nice things away. Even if you do, it doesn't actually mean you've renounced them. Renunciation is a totally inner experience. It means less craving. It means being more reasonable instead of putting too much psychological pressure on yourself and acting crazy. The important point for us to know then is that we should have less grasping at sense pleasures because most of our time, our grasping at and craving desire for worldly pleasure doesn't give us satisfaction. In fact, it leads to more dissatisfaction. So, I mean, there's a whole chapter on that, which is really fantastic from Lama Yeshe. There's quite a hard-hitting quote here from Lama Zopa Rinpoche too, about the flame being dominated by ignorance. So I'll read it out. When moths see a candle flame, they think it's a good place to go. They don't think that it'll burn their body. They have no fear. They are expecting only peace and happiness. They have no desire to suffer. They don't plan on getting burnt, but the mental obscuration of ignorance makes them perceive the situation differently from the fact of it. Their ignorance prevents them from discovering the actual nature of the situation. It forces them to experience suffering. I mean, it's so profound and it's so tragic, isn't it? And some of us may have friends that have self-destructive behavior and we just tear our hair out for them. We want to help, and yet the instinctual behavior, or from a Buddhist point of view, the karmic behavior is so overwhelming and the momentum is so strong that it's really difficult to help. And really, you can't help until each of us individually comes to that realization, ah, I've got to give up the causes of the suffering. I think in colloquial terms, that's when we hit rock bottom, isn't it? That's the rock bottom. And so then we can change the direction. So how are we feeling about this? Does it ring any bells? Yep, I've seen a few wry smiles there, so that's good. So then we have the suffering, we have those three levels of suffering, and actually the Buddhist teachings are mostly about that most subtle level, about that ignorance, the all-pervasive compounding suffering, where the more we do, the worse we make things. That's really what the Buddhist teachings are about, the kind of the changeable ha happiness, how it changes into suffering, and the obvious suffering of pain. Those things all religions and even no religions can focus on and help to a degree. But the underlying driver, the cause of it, of not realizing how those grasping at the external things not only doesn't get us the satisfaction that we want, but it actually compounds all of our problems. That's really the main task of Buddhist teachings. Questions, comments?
I have a question. So
Yeah, Linda.
if you're ignorant of something, then and that continues the suffering cycle, how do you become aware and no longer ignorant and then break that cycle of suffering? I mean, if you never
Yeah.
really know what the cause is, what happens?
That's right. This is really where most of us find ourselves in that predicament. So what happens? Usually it's the kindness of others. Somebody else shares their experience and helps us. And so this is why in a Buddhist center, a spiritual teacher or guru is called a spiritual friend, because they're a friend that helps us in this particular area to get out of suffering forever. So they're our spiritual friend, in my view, the most important type of friend, because we have friends that teach us to cook, friends that teach us how to put makeup on, you know. But the friend that can teach us how to avoid suffering and stop being addicted to the causes of suffering, that is rare. It's really rare. Not everybody comes across this. And it takes a very astute person to come up with it themselves. So many people do think about this and come up with some things and then go investigating Western philosophy, Eastern philosophy, and then kind of go on this detective chase to try and work it out. And so, but even that, we have to have the fortune of knowing how to read.
Is there any benefit to suffering at all? I mean, I guess if you learn from it, then there's some benefit there. But like you said, unless you can see it, unless somebody can show it to you, then.
You can definitely learn from it, but yes, there's a huge benefit to suffering, which is just as well, because what are we going to do if we can't get rid of the suffering? It's the it is the absolute crucial condition for developing a good heart. So if we don't know what it's like to suffer, we can never develop compassion. It's like if you have a doctor that's never been sick, they are not going to understand what you're going through. So you don't have to have any smarts. If you experience suffering, you can have that to help develop a good heart, that when you see somebody else going through the same thing, immediately you're open to them, immediately you want to help. And as we know, just someone being there, recognizing that we're in difficulty, just even being a companion, even if they can't help, just being there, that's half of it fixed already.
Okay. All right.
So there's no kind of like moral virtue about suffering, but it can be incredibly beneficial no matter what. Okay, great. Oh yes, Piggy. Oh, you have to unmute, dear.
Sorry about that.
Yes.
It also makes me have a huge amount of gratitude when I'm not suffering. So I wouldn't have the same kind of gratitude if I didn't go through the suffering. So that has helped me be happy internally, because I'm just happy when I'm not feeling pain, or I'm happy when I'm not craving those attachments, those relationships that I get attached to. And it brings me pain. So when I don't have, so I think I want those, but when I don't have them, I'm a lot happier. But I only
I
know that
get.
I'm happier because I don't, because I suffered when I had them.
Yes, so we have a comparison, and
Yes.
even though like the comparison's in memory, it's definitely there. But again, it's like at each moment we can have a choice, because I often think we have this general idea about happiness, but then if someone asks me, "Are you happy?" It's a really difficult question to answer, because sometimes I can be going through a really terrible time, but I'm so clear in my mind finally how to act, how to not retaliate, how to think about something. All of my prayers are really sincere, that actually it's a really good time. So then I'm like, is it a good time? Or is it a difficult time? Can it be both? It really depends. So it's not a fun time, but all of the benefit that comes is it's so deep and sincere and sustaining that almost it's better than the times where I'm just like having, feeling fine, happy-go-lucky. So again, it's like we have a
Yes.
general idea, but when we investigate, it really depends how we look at it. So, yeah, if you have gratitude for just a nice simple day when you're not suffering and you really appreciate it, that can be a profound thing.
Well, the word content comes to mind too for me.
Yeah, it's something we want, but I think it's something we've got to be careful of, because content can be just because our suffering isn't manifest. And the moment conditions change, the
Yeah.
weather or our health, friendships, then we're upset. So that's like the circumstantial content. And that's quite different from content in your heart in the midst of a disaster.
Yes. But
Yeah,
content doesn't necessarily mean happiness to me either. It's
no, that's right.
two different things to me.
Yeah.
I like what you're saying. It's content in your heart.
Yep, that's it. That's the real crucial thing. So, not dependent on what comes from out there. Yeah. And the same with the happiness, too.
Thanks.
Yes, very good. Thank you. So,
Question.
renunciation, it actually can make our life better. So it's not that we're giving up all the good things. If we have renunciation, the things that we have now, we will be able to enjoy. So it doesn't mean giving up all of our friends or possessions or comfortable chair or our afternoon in the sun or anything like that. What it is giving up a distorted relationship to them. So to recognize how they're ephemeral. They come and they go and they're quite fragile. So when they're there, really appreciate them. And if they're not perfect, that's okay, because nothing in samsara is perfect. So when we don't have renunciation, we might get something really good, but we're thinking, oh, it's not quite right. It's not as good as yesterday's, so we're not happy. So the distorted relationship, the expectations, is what brings the suffering. So if we do develop this sense of renunciation, immediately we're just going to relax, because what is there we'll enjoy. We won't stress so much. We'll be naturally optimistic, because we have things in context. And the fact that anything comes together nicely, that is really amazing to be appreciated. Over our lifespan, our lifetime, our mind will be much more stable. And because we won't be distracted by just trying to make ourselves comfortable and feel good all the time, we will achieve our goals. We will be able to make our life meaningful. And that means that then when our death time comes, we'll be able to die without regret. So, if we want to have a good life and die without regret, renunciation is crucial, or we won't have that inner experience of making our life worthwhile or meaningful or being content in our heart. From a Buddhist point of view, the ultimate benefit of renunciation is it's the thing that means that we can actually emerge out of samsara. So that means a complete and permanent cessation of all suffering, of all the levels of suffering. And why that is possible is because it's not that you're just removing this and removing that, but you've removed the cause of suffering from your own mind. So you've removed all of the confusion and the dissatisfaction and the grasping. So it doesn't matter what happens, your mind is undisturbed. So that's real freedom, that kind of inner confidence. That's the real freedom. So the long-term benefit for renunciation is nothing less than nirvana. Then we've talked a little bit about how we get distracted by the external things. And so what these distractions are commonly called are the eight worldly concerns. Worldly as in not being judgmental that worldly is somehow inferior, but worldly as in the nature of the world is unstable. These things, they're dependent on causes and conditions. They're dependent on how we look at them on their paths. And we are tossed willy-nilly if we believe the appearances. If we rely on these worldly concerns, we will find ourselves going up and down continuously. We'll have no stability because they are unreliable. So let's have a look at these eight worldly concerns, and then we can have a little chat about some examples. So they're divided into four pairs. Something that we seek instinctually, we move towards, and something that we instinctually avoid or move away from. So the first pair is seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. So seeking comfort all the time. And we might think, oh yeah, uncomfortable, but that's just because we can wriggle. But if you've ever done a Vipassana course where you have to sit headset still without wriggling, very quickly you're in agony. So that sense of pleasure only comes because we can adjust things all the time. And we get lulled into this kind of false sense of security that everything is fine. But that's just because we can jump from one thing to the other. We're constantly seeking this pleasure. And the moment that we don't get it, then there's the pain. And there's the discomfort, and we can't bear it. So, on one hand, seeking the pleasure, and here I've put a picture of a chocolate cake because that's kind of a meme in Buddhism. One piece of chocolate cake is delicious, therefore, two pieces of chocolate cake are doubly delicious, and three pieces are even better. And as we know, by the time it's four pieces, then it's real sickness. So, if the pleasure existed in the chocolate cake, four pieces, we should be enlightened by then. Clearly, that's not the case. But nevertheless, we continuously grasp after pleasures again and again and again. And on the other hand, we avoid the pain. So, when we avoid the pain, classic example about this is if you've ever avoided going to the dentist. So people have a real fear of the dentist. And so we avoid the dentist, and what happens to our teeth? Like they just long-term catastrophe right there. So we have a fear of pain and all of the bad experiences and everything. And so at any cost, we'll avoid that pain. And until we get a toothache that it's so big, that our cheek is out here and we can't talk anymore, and we're ready to just get a pin and pop it. And then it's like, oh no, now I really have to go to the dentist. So then I've gone to the dental hospital, and then you wait there for ages and ages. And actually, so I'm speaking from my own experience, and you go there, and then dentist and the attendants, they actually laughed at me. Because they did get a pin and pop it, and all of the stuff exploded, and they're like, why didn't you come in earlier? There you go. So that's how we do it. Short term. So short term, isn't it? And why? Because we just get sucked into the pleasure or the pain without thinking of the bigger picture. Oh, and also with the pain, so for the dentist, we're thinking about everything that's frightening about the dentist rather than the benefit that could come. And so that's the thing about just avoiding the suffering of pain. We forget that there is going to be a benefit in there. And so then we deprive ourselves of that benefit. That's the real tragedy of it. We seek gain, we try and avoid loss. So advertisers know this because they know that we love a bargain. And so they'll put all these crappy things on sale, buy one, get five free or whatever. And so then we spend all this money thinking that we're getting a bargain, but actually it breaks in 2 weeks. Need to get another one and another one. Why are there still sales, and why do people still fall for it? Because we want to have a profit, and we like acquiring things. that whole saying, good money after bad. Once we've committed, we don't want to lose, so we will commit even more. We try and avoid loss and deterioration. So put here a picture of a bald man, because the amount of money that's spent on trying to overcome baldness, or is it, that in itself is a tragedy. All of the scams and things in the world, the email scams, the phishing and everything, it all works on this psychology that human beings want to gain something and they don't want to lose. And so intelligent, educated, incredibly smart people fall for these scams. Everybody falls for these scams. Why? Because it's not based on logic. It's based on this worldly concern. More and don't want to lose what I've got. Another example is if you, I've heard stories of people getting mugged and the robbers saying, give us your jewelry. And the person has said, no way am I handing over my wedding ring. And so then they lose their life. So it's like, no, you're not getting my stuff, or you're not getting my wallet, or you're not getting my jewelry, but you lose something else. You either get, assaulted or you lose your life. So this, it's very deeply ingrained and it really catches us out all the time. So any other any things to add about these two, the pleasure and pain or gain and loss? Perhaps it's too embarrassing, the things to add. That's fair enough too. I'll just furnish you all with the embarrassing stories. Okay. So then we've got the next two, praise and blame. We seek admiration and approval. We really need it. We crave that acknowledgement. And if we don't get it, we somehow feel like we don't even exist as a person. And we avoid the criticism. We avoid constructive feedback. We certainly don't like being blamed for things. So, very closely associated with this are the other two, success and failure. We like to feel ourselves as a winner, not a loser. And these two things can really have an effect on what we do with our life. Because so many people, for instance, with the failure, won't try something new because they're frightened of failure. They're frightened of being humiliated, or frightened of making a mistake, not being the top of the class. Frightened of, especially if you're really good at some things and you find yourself trying to learn a new thing and you're no good at it, your whole sense of who you are suddenly collapses. So much of our identity is tied up in, for instance, status and maintaining that status. And so people who have quite a high status are quite siloed. So I remember one time I was leading one of these classes, and there were some social workers every now and again would bring people to the class. And so one of the social workers came along, and she must have been quite new out of college. So she was there with her charge that she was looking after for the day, who was quite kind of messy and a little disturbed. So he was there in front row, and he interrupted all the time and had all these questions, but they were really good questions. He was genuinely asking questions. She sat in the back row with eyes like saucers, like a bunny in the headlights. She was terrified. I'm like, why is she terrified? She's in this beautiful environment and everybody's nice to her. And you know why she was terrified? Because suddenly she was in a situation where she didn't understand. She didn't know what was talking about, and she wasn't top of the class. And so that felt to her like a failure. And that then felt like then therefore she is a failure. And so she couldn't even speak. I was so shocked. And I've seen that with really well-educated people sometimes come to a Buddhist center and they're so thrown because suddenly they're coming across things that they don't understand and they've so identified with being the smartest one that being a beginner is deeply uncomfortable. And not only that, then they layer on top of it, therefore it's no good. So this is why all the lamas say we're always a beginner. And they always say themselves they're a beginner because that's the most comfortable place to be. You can get an F and you can go, great, I got a mark. The other one I was thinking about well, of course, with success and fame, that can be a real trap too. I mean, there's very, very few famous people that are happy. And most of the incredible rock stars and whoever are the ones that manage to be that are happy are the ones managed to be a bit anonymous. So I remember Tom Waits saying how it's great. He could walk down the street and nobody recognizes him. And if he ever wants to be recognized, he has to put on some really amazing shoes. And but otherwise, he's got total freedom and anonymity. Whereas if you're Taylor Swift, you can't go and buy a loaf of bread. You can't go anywhere you want to go and just relax. Not possible for the rest of your life. So here, I remember when we're kiddies, and everyone says, "What do you want to be?" And you go, "I want to be rich and famous." And I started thinking, why? That's awful. Both of those things are awful. Both of those things ruin your life normally. And if you chase after them, the happiness doesn't come with those things. And yet it's so ingrained, isn't it? The other thing about the worldly concerns when it comes to praise and blame, another of my friends just had to recently be a whistleblower in their workplace. And so this is one where you're really between a rock and a hard place. Because if you're a whistleblower, you become a pariah. And it's you could ruin your career options. Generally, if you're the one that brings the bad news, you are the seen as the cause of the bad news. Like if everybody tries to get somebody else to deliver the bad news. Why? Because we get associated with it. And so being a whistleblower is a really tough thing to do, and it can have real world effects. At the same time, if you don't say anything, then you get eaten up inside and you can't live with yourself. So it's a really difficult thing. And if you make that decision on praise and blame, if that's what makes you be quiet, then for the whole rest of your life, that also will have consequences, which is that you feel incredibly bad for not saying something. And you can never undo that. So when we make our decisions on praise from others or blame from others, avoiding the blame, seeking the approval, we might get the short term. Our comfort level is maintained, but long term, it can be really disastrous. And I mean, you might have made decisions in your life based on these worldly considerations, and it hasn't turned out so well. I know I have, and it hasn't turned out so well. And I've tried to figure out why did it go wrong, and it's pretty much been because of these, because the way I've made my decision has been to do with this, not having courage, I suppose. So how are we going with that? Has it brought up anything, any questions or comments? Does it ring a bell?
I'm
Worldly
feeling a
considerations?
little. I have a
Oh,
question.
okay, so let's go. We've got a couple. And Angelina.
I'm feeling like it feels a bit impossible, to give up the
craving to give up attachment. I mean, like, we have relationships, we have romantic relationships and fam, like, I don't want to see people I love die. Like, just everything feels like impossible to just give up. So when that feels like what is the first step to just understand a distorted relationship, I guess, is that what we should be focusing
You
on?
don't have to give up everything. It's not everything. It's okay. But so we can just take it step by step. So we don't want to be unhappy. That's a no-brainer. And so then we've got to see, well, what are the things that make us unhappy long term? Because the things that make us unhappy short term, we can pretty much identify. There's no problem there. But there's this whole category of things where short term it's difficult and long term it's worth it. So, for instance, going to school, not so many people enjoyed that, but it was an investment in yourself for the rest of your life. And so if you've done exams, that's what you tell yourself. You go, yeah, the short term pain, it's going to be over and it's worth it because, and you tell yourself the benefits that are going to come. So it's trying to have this long-term view, and these worldly concerns, they kind of tunnel vision us down into the short term, where we don't say anything because we're embarrassed at the moment, or because we're frightened at the time, or we put off something. We put off having to have the talk with someone, or we put off the important thing because it's distasteful to us, and we're thinking about all the reasons why we don't want to do it, and we put it off and put it off and put it off till it's too late. So the thing is to be able to look at the long term and not be so reactive in the immediate term, because all of these worldly concerns are reactivity. They're just reacting to, I don't like that or I like that. It's very, there's not much analysis or reasoning going on with them. And mostly how we act has nothing to do with reasoning. It's just on our instincts. So we have to slowly retrain ourselves, change our behavior. Change our instincts. So, I mean, one example where this happens is I've seen with my friends who've become parents. That retrains your instincts from wanting to sleep in, from just wanting to sleep to getting up. Just really simple. I know people that have never gotten up before that have slept in the whole time and then they had children, and boy, total change. But actually, if you just think about how you can't bear not sleeping in anymore, you get really, really unhappy. But with most parents, you think about how much you love your child, and then that keeps your mind happy. And you've got the long term. You've got the long term view, and you're thinking about the benefit rather than the immediate reactivity. His Holiness the Dalai Lama also was saying, like, whenever we need to make decisions, make them for the long term. And that's that, rather than the immediate response, that can really help loosen our what is it, our addiction to just the immediate appearances of things. So I hope that's something to go on, Angelina. And I mean, the other thing is to just develop a sense of relishing it when you notice that you're sucked into these worldly concerns. So instead of going, oh no, it's happened again, go, great, I've spotted it. I've caught you out. And just notice it happening. We mightn't be able to do anything about it straight away, but at least to notice it happening while it's happening, that's a good step. And again, it's ironically, it's a little bit uncomfortable, but on a deeper level, it'll give you a lot more confidence. just to notice them in play. So let's do this little contemplation then on a little excursion into the eight worldly concerns. Okay, so take a nice deep breath, and as you let out any tension from the neck and the shoulders. Adjust your posture so your spine is naturally straight, feeling comfortable in your seat. And let's take a moment to think about gain and loss. Just ask some questions of yourself. For instance, do you want more possessions than you actually need? Do the possessions that you have bring the lasting and complete happiness? Or do you also worry about losing them? Do you own your possessions, or do your possessions own you? What do you need to remember to be able to enjoy your possessions? And then thinking about success and failure. How are they bound together? For instance, does success in one area threaten happiness or stability in other areas of your life? Is there an ultimate success? Is there such a thing as success that cannot be lost or superseded? And with failure, is it all bad? Or is the experience bad, but the analysis revealing? Can you think of any of the amazing inventions in the world that came first from failure? And then taking a moment to think about praise and criticism. Do compliments and nice words make a real difference in your life? Are they ever enough? How dependent are you on the appreciation of others? What happens if you're not acknowledged? And how can we learn from our mistakes if we avoid criticism? Does criticism of what we've done, is that criticism of who we are as a living being? And then lastly, about pleasure and pain. Are either of them a permanent or lasting thing? Are the momentary pleasures worth the effort Is there anything that we can learn from difficulties? So by pursuing the eight worldly concerns, we put so much effort in to avoiding even the slightest discomfort, but we're like a moth flying to the flame. So take a moment to think, what are you giving up whilst being immersed in these worldly concerns? What are you giving up that you value the most for these immediate or temporary comforts? Or in other words, what would you be doing right now if you knew you couldn't fail? So, letting the insights to this meditation just settle in your mind, taking note of your spontaneous answers, bringing them into your daily life. And take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. So, with this meditation, letting go of the eight worldly concerns. Gain and loss, success and failure, praise and criticism, pleasure and pain. And the bumper sticker for this week, folks, is don't give up what you want most for what you want now. So, what we want most, it's the well-being of ourselves, our family, our loved ones, using our time wisely, contributing to the world in a positive way, all of those things. And then we might have really specific things, these long-term goals. And how much of the time are we just distracted from them? Just by immediate concerns, frittering away time, spending all those hours at work and no time with those that we love. So don't give up what you want most for what you want now. So I just got a couple of slides to sum up this one. It's the attachment that ruins everything. So attachment, it feels, attachment says if something feels good, therefore it must be good. If it feels good, it is good. And that is a mistake. The way attachment experiences things, that's a mistake. So attachment overvalues things, it's biased, it has expectations and projections. And this is how those worldly concerns overtake us. And they're short term, they're instant gratification. And the problem with this is that many times short term activities do bring satisfaction, and that's why we get addicted to them. But long term, it makes things worse. So we can distract ourselves with entertainment and all sorts of sports and hobbies and all sorts of things. But in the long term, if we don't learn how to connect with others, if we don't nurture our relationships, in the long term, we'll feel worse and worse. And slowly we won't be able to do all of those distraction things. And then people, that's why people have midlife crisis and find themselves alone and isolated, because the short-term entertainments have overridden this real long-term need that we have. So following craving deprives us of peace and lasting happiness. It's the following the craving that's the problem. So here, shut up and give me the cookie. You might have heard about this experiment that they did with the short-term gratification of the kiddies. They got all these kids, they stuck them in a room one by one with a pile of a plate of cookies in front of them. And then they said, you can have one cookie now, or you can have two cookies later. And then they filmed these poor kitties what they did. And so they did everything to try and distract themselves, not looking at the cookies, sitting on their hands, saying, no cookie, no cookie, no cookie, looking really intently at the cookie, going, not eating, not eating, not eating, all of these things, whatever it took. And then there were a few kids that just busted and just ate the cookie straight away. And so then they tracked these kids over time. And of course, what was found was that it wasn't so much your education and socioeconomic status that determined how you went in your life. It was about this impulse that the kiddies that just took the cookie straight away, they were the ones that ended up with much more difficult circumstances, regardless of where they started off in the beginning. Anyway, I heard about this study and I thought, oh no, kitty that took the cookie. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. To a degree, this is all of us, isn't it? Shut up and give me the cookie. And yeah, we get the cookie, but we don't get anything else. So the reason why we want the cookie all the time and why we need a cookie every day, one cookie when I was six wasn't enough, is because our dissatisfaction reveals something very profound. That our consumerism, our constantly being able to get the cookie, to find better cookies, to plan for the cookies, all of this following the craving masks the hollowness of an exterior life, of depending on our happiness through external means. Because if we can't cultivate a sense of contentment in our heart, we will never have enough cookies. There just won't be enough cookies. We just have to look at any old millionaire to know that. And when they ask a millionaire, how much is enough, they always say, oh, just a couple million more. So it's the attachment. It's not the things, but the attachment that ruins everything. How do we keep it level head? Keep calm and don't lose your head. On the wisdom side of things, cultivate a natural, realistic optimism. So being flexible, understanding that things depend on circumstances, conditions, our attitude. It means things are flexible. And so then we can relax. And when things change, we can discover the good in a situation. We can discover the opportunity. On the renunciation side of things, recognize how attachment ruins everything. So happiness, it can't come from outside first. That's not where it comes from. It comes from our capacity to enjoy. It comes from us. And don't sweat the small stuff. So this is more to do with the bodhicitta aspect, which we'll talk about next week, of recognizing, yeah, life is fleeting. What matters to us is a lot more than just our life. It's the well-being of others, isn't it? It's the well-being of those around us who we're responsible for. It's the well-being of all the animals of the planet. So getting stuck in this discomfort or that discomfort, really, the big picture, the benefit of others, that will lift us out of it. So I do have one more topic to just introduce you to. So before we go on any further, are there any comments or questions about all this, the worldly concerns, the renunciation, and the attachment? How are we going with that? Is it clear enough? Something enough to work with? So I know you're probably quite overwhelmed by all of this now, but I've thrown in this other kind of topic about so what can we rely on? Because this is what the natural question that came up for me. If we've got these worldly considerations that are unstable and unreliable, we can't rely on them. If it's our attachment that ruins everything, we can't rely on that. So So what can we follow? What can we rely on? And in a way, this is like from a Buddhist point of view, it's asking, well, what's something valid and reliable? Instead of that worldly considerations, concerns going up and down, what can actually help us and free us instead of make us more and more in bondage? And it's worth looking at this because we might see where we've slightly gone wrong, where we take our advice from, what we actually rely on. So, where do we currently seek our guidance and protection? Well, we seek a lot of protection in those worldly concerns of just food and entertainment and status and all of that. And guidance, well, that can be quite happenstance as well. So, if we want to actually rely on something, a path or a person, we've got to have criteria so that we can have confidence. And so there's four criteria. And the first one is whoever we rely on, they themselves must be free. They have to have freed themselves from the thing that we seek to be freed from. If we want to be free of poverty, we have to go and find someone who has freed themselves from poverty. And if we want to be free of the rat race, we have to find someone who has freed themselves from the rat race. And if we want to be free of emotional disturbance, we have to rely on someone that has no emotional disturbance anymore. So we have to really do some searching here. And what we'll find is our dear friends who care about us and love us and who we love hanging out with, they haven't freed themselves from the bondage of samsara, just like us, and that's why we can't rely on our friends. That's why we have to rely on a spiritual friend, someone who actually knows the way out of this bondage. So again, it's not a judgmental thing, but we've just got to get smart about this. Not only that, not only have they freed themselves, but they have to have a method to share with us, a method to be able to free others. So, something, a program that we can get with and we can replicate and have the same result. So, a method. So, this is where organized religion comes in handy because it's often tried and true methods. And a lot of self-help books now that have been around for 20, 30, 40 years, also, they're reliable methods. The nonviolent communication, the how to win friends and influence people, the six thinking hats, all of those things, they're effective methods to help in those kind of situations. So with those two, we really got to check who are we going to put our trust in. And then we see, do they have a reliable method? Can't just be good-hearted, they have to have a method. So this is good for a spiritual path, but it's also good for if you're going to choose who you're going to believe in politically, or if you're going to choose a philosophy, or even if you're going to choose a sporting team or an arts teacher. You can put them through this criteria and you'll be able to see, are they really worth it? Even a business venture, you can go through and see, you can apply this criteria. I really find it's quite universal. So those two of having the ability. And then the other two, that they have great compassion for all and are unbiased. So it's not just for them, it's not just for their people, but for everyone. So the method will help their people, but it's certainly not going to harm the others. But best is that by helping ourselves, we also help everybody. So again, even if you're just looking at businesses, if you might have a great business, but if it has incredible pollution, no way, it's not a good thing to invest in. And helping without favoritism or helping without rewards. So that means that in particular, when it comes to religion, possibly medicine, that everybody is helped, regardless of whether you're rich or poor, regardless of whether you pay thousands of dollars or just make a donation of $1. So the favoritism of only helping the ones that are going to reward me, red flags. So this is really handy when you're looking at all the various wonderful courses that you want to do. You can just see, okay, is it the big picture helping this group of people, but it also benefits society as a whole? And are they going to help regardless of whether you're a good person or bad person, whether you're rich or poor? Very quickly, you're going to be able to see, is this a valid source of refuge? Is this a valid course? Is this a valid philosophy? It's nice. It's nice to be able to have this criteria. Otherwise, you just go on a gut feeling, which may or may not be right, or you go on the advertising, which may or may not be right. Most people make their decisions by how they feel about things. It's not a reasoned. It's not a reasoned process. Including most people, that's how they vote, isn't it? They vote on their feelings. They don't vote on rationality or reason. And so they vote for things that are just going to bring disaster upon themselves. Why? Not because we're dumb or stupid, but because we don't have this, we haven't thought about the criteria, and we don't act with reasoning and logic. We just act with feeling, and usually it's a short-term feeling. So the whole disaster happens. So renunciation is about letting go of that. So investigate using your reasoning and logic, and check with your own experience. Check up then. You can still use your gut feeling, your instinct, checking up with your own experience, but it's got to be supplemented with reasoning and logic and some evidence and things like that. And so, of course, that takes effort, effort and time. And of course, as people get more distressed and the world gets more difficult, there's less and less time to analyze, to stop and think about it. So, from our point of view, what we can do is try and slow things down and just be kind and create the space for some reasoning to happen. So, does anyone find that relevant or useful? Checklist? Yeah. I mean, in a way, oftentimes it's in hindsight, isn't it? But if you've got to make some big decisions, it's a really good checklist to have. Before I do the summary and before we talk about next week's homework and reflection sheet, is there anything else, even just random things anyone would like to add or share? Go for it.
I'm toying with I talking about, I sometimes I want to kick myself lately because I try to think about, like who I'm supporting if I buy something, or look, where was it made, and how is it made or whatever. And then I bought a Tesla to be good for the environment. Right? So it's good for the environment. And my heart was in the right place kind of when I bought it, but now I'm starting to find out that I'm not happy about supporting Elon Musk.
That's right.
And
Well,
so
there's a new bumper sticker out. There's a bumper sticker that people have been sticking on their Teslas saying, "I bought this before I knew who Elon was." So
yeah.
just
I kind of, I don't think I would have bought the car now that I, because there's so much that I don't like about him now, and now I'm kind of embarrassed when I drive it. But it's hard because things are so complicated, and there's corporations that sometimes you think you're doing something, and then you find out if you do enough research that they weren't as good as you thought they were, and you kind of supported the bad guy or what you would
That's
consider.
right. So I mean, it's incredibly commendable that you're doing the research and putting the effort in, and that's really good, and it's good on all levels because one, it's going to just being aware of this, just educating ourselves, it comes out in conversation, it changes the whole zeitgeist of the society, and this is what we have to do to change as a society. But a society is one person at a time. So even if it's just us talking with a friend or a neighbor, just one person at a time, this is how it happens. And after a while, it reaches a, level where it escalates. So don't underestimate that. It's really important. And same thing, corporations are made of people. And it's human beings in there, and it's the human beings having conversations. That's where change starts. And then eventually it is reflected in corporations. So we've always got to be aware that there are human beings involved and keep that humanity. And then we've got to be really smart and really long term and plan things and elect people and throw your weight behind various causes and things and even like even if I'm not going to go out and go on demonstrations, I'm going to support the people who are. So you find your level where you can. And it's really crucial that we do this. And it's always it's a changeable feast. It's a moving feast, isn't it? Like, the car isn't inherently good. It depends, and the conditions change and it's changed. But we can use that as a humorous way to continue the dialogue. So write your own bumper sticker and put it on there. And so then humor is one of the best ways to do it. And so I find all these memes. I'm addicted to memes at the moment. So I've been reading all the memes about politics and whatever. And it's such a great way to get a point across whilst being friendly. It's more skillful than any, politics, philosophy, religion—just the insight that comes with the humor—it's really skillful, and it's skillful because there's that absurdity that it's like a Zen moment, but there's friendliness, and that's something that we have over all the other aggression and hatred that's going around, which is a tightening. Actually, our advantage is that we can practice good-heartedness. And that's the only thing that's going to triumph in the end. It's got to come from this good-heartedness, and then we slot in the wisdom. The best way to slot in the wisdom is with humor. As we know, I mean, the whole history of America could go with the history of the comedy club, can't it? Of how society changes and how we have dialogue about society. So then we just got to be ready to change, isn't it? Circumstances change, we change. And it's difficult because with renunciation, with all of our enjoyment of the modern world of things online and AI and internet, this and that, all of this, it is a suffering that we're running towards in a way, because the effects on the environment are happening as we speak, and we're experiencing that, and we'll continue to. And by the time it turns into the suffering of pain, it's like the hangover. It's too late. You can't undo it.
Great. Scary, yeah, true.
It is. It's really scary. And so again, if we're dominated by the eight worldly concerns, we'll go, it's scary, I don't want to think about it, and we shut down. So courage, yes, it's scary, it's painful, and we don't want to know about it, but it's worth investigating. And just for our long-term sustainability. And nicely enough, the way that we can do it without shutting down in panic and being overwhelmed is by just doing a few things yourself or on the right track. Like changing what kind of car you buy, or like investigating, the groceries that you buy when making a decision. It may not have a big effect on the world, but ethically, you're going in the right direction, and that'll make you feel better. And then you won't collapse from the enormity of it all. We've got to give ourselves some feel-good fuel here so that then we can do the actual work. Oh, okay. So thank you. Thank you, Linda. That was a really great point. So, in summary, we've got renouncing suffering. Yeah, we all do that. Renouncing the causes of suffering. As we know, this is an incredible challenge. But if we do develop renunciation, the result is we will enjoy the life we have more. What we have, we will really enjoy. And who doesn't want that? It's the eight worldly concerns that distract us from long-term goals, what really matters to us, and from long-term happiness. The best way to keep a level head is to find a valid spiritual path, one that sits well with you, in one that you have that you have can then have real confidence in, regardless of how you feel about things. And the bumper sticker, don't give up what you want most for what you want now. Just before we dedicate, then next week, during the week, there is the worksheet. Please email Lana Medicine Buddha if you haven't got the worksheets yet, and you'll be able to download one. It's just some reflections. There's a little meditation there. And Lama Yeshe's advice to check up, is it for the short-term comfort or is it actually mirroring your values? And then next week's the last class of this very short course. So it's on bodhicitta, how to develop a natural affection for all and how to live without fear and surrounded by friends. So let's dedicate all of our energy today for coming along. Those of you in the back row, very nice to see you all there. I can see your name, so I know you're there. All of the energy that you put into thinking, into dealing with discomfort. Really appreciate your efforts and your good-heartedness, and dedicate for us all to be able to release the causes of suffering and bring a sense of peace and joy to our own heart and to everyone around us. So thank you so much, everybody.